Two things, if I can say before I begin. One is I would like to acknowledge Chris Waller works in my office, and he has volunteered to help out on the brief and volunteered to come here without pay. It wasn't too hard to convince him to come to New Orleans, but I would like to say if y'all find any merit with my argument, then I would like to share the credit. If you don't, then I'll take responsibility for it, but he has helped out. The second thing is I would like to acknowledge that at the first that this case has been difficult when I started researching issues and preparing for oral argument in regards to the due process argument stated in the brief. I have researched and come up with two issues that I do want to bring up with the court. The third issue, due process, I think I can make an argument too, but that's only with the if I have time and the court wants to hear it. I know, of course, Judge Smith, in your opinion, in Singleton and Clark, the due process argument has been fairly well taken care of with a stolen firearm. However, I want to start with the initial question of whether or not this firearm had an obliterated serial number or an altered serial number. I wanted to start by saying when I researched that definition, there are no definitions in the statute. The definitions, I could not find them even in one of the cases or the main 922K violation. But I did look in the dictionary, and I found that obliterate means to do away with completely so as to leave no trace, to wipe out, rub off, or erase. It's clear from the sentencing when the court asked the probation officer, what about this obliteration, when I objected to it, clearly the agent was able to make out the serial number, ran through a nexus search, and they were able to find out where it came from. The next step then is, well, if it's not obliterated, which means completely gone and was able to be seen, maybe it was altered. I couldn't find a good definition of altered, but I did find something close to it, which was a material alteration I found from Black's Law Dictionary. It involves a document, which of course this isn't, but it may be guiding. Any alteration of a document that changes its legal effect. I want to argue to the courts the proposition that there's a difference between alter and obliterate. Obliterate means the number's gone and can't be found out. Alter means it's changed its way in a legally significant way. You took some of the numbers and changed it from a F to a B, thereby making it unable to be traced, which I believe is the background of this section. It's the public interest in being able to trace firearms. If a number's obliterated, it makes it very hard to trace. If it's altered or changed its number again, very hard to trace. If you take a less stringent definition of altered, it could be anything. Altered theoretically means a gun that's old and worn and the number has become worn down. Well, that would be altered then. Or a firearm that's been dropped and scratched. Theoretically, that's been altered. So I urge the court to take a stricter definition of altered. But I would ask the court to look at that issue, as I don't see a definition of those two words. The next argument that I have is the question of whether or not this firearm was used in conjunction with another felony offense. I believe that it was not. I believe that the court's findings, if we can call them that, indicate that in reality, she didn't either. And I'd point the court's attention to the sentencing transcript where the judge states that basically the judge is stating that, well, you know, shooting a firearm anywhere in the city limits is dangerous. And that seems to indicate to me that maybe she did not believe that this firearm was fired at another group of individuals. The question then is, was there a Rule 32 violation? Did the court, we objected to all the conduct that was stated in regards to this firearm being fired at another group of individuals. The government in its brief And the government at sentencing just stated what was in the PSI, which we objected to. There's no controverting evidence presented at sentencing. Rule 32, to my understanding, requires that where there's a contested issue in the pre-sentence investigation report, that the judge has to either make certain findings, attach them to the PSI, or state on the record that she's not going to use them or consider them in sentencing. That wasn't done here. So at the very least, I believe there's a Rule 32 violation. It needs to be remanded back so the judge can say whether or not she considered it in sentencing. So that's basically the two issues that I have that I think I have a shot at. As far as due process goes, I'd like to take a shot at that, and I of course know where this court stands on it. I know that it's hard, but let me see if I can change your minds. Clearly in Singleton, in regards to a firearm that's been stolen, there's no due process violation. It is interesting to me to note that if a person who is not a felon possesses a firearm that has an obliterated serial number, there is a mens rea requirement to it. There has to be a knowing aspect to it. However, when a person has been found guilty or has pled guilty to an offense, the guidelines are clear that you don't need to prove that the person knew about it in the application notes of the guidelines. But that seems to me, and the only argument I can come up with on that I think holds water, is that it seems to do an end run around those constitutional protections that a person would normally have. And I want to put forth a scenario and see whether or not it fits. If a felon sells a firearm to another individual which does not have an obliterated serial number, a scratched-off serial number, and that person subsequently commits an act that scratches the serial number off, he gets arrested for whatever reason, they find the gun, they go back, who'd you buy it from? Well, I bought it from person X, who is a prohibited person. They now know that that person possessed the firearm. It may not have been scratched off when it was in his possession. However, according to the guidelines that I see, if it is a strict liability sentencing factor, then theoretically he would be good for the four level increase. And that just, it doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair. And it seems like a violation of due process. So I understand again that there is a difference between a crime and a sentencing enhancement, and I don't know if I'm going to open another can of worms, but I do want to ask the court to think about before Apprendi, and I know that Apprendi and all of the progeny that came from Apprendi is now not really relevant as the guidelines are not mandatory. It seems to me, as at least as part of the Supreme Court's thinking is that they wanted juries to make some of these deciding issues. And I guess, in theory, a jury could still make those issues without a mens rea, but that really is against our general rule of law. The general rule of law that I believe, in all the cases that I looked at about firearms violations, true crimes, required a mens rea requirement. And it just seems that to be fair to an individual, there has to be some sort of mental element to even this sentencing factor. Maybe not intentionally or knowingly, maybe recklessly or criminal negligence. And so that's my argument as far as due process goes. And that's really what I'm coming to talk about today.
All right. You saved time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Berry.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Mr. Stith, Richard Berry from the United States Attorney's Office. We're here today on two sentencing enhancement issues, both four-level enhancements, one for possession or use of a firearm bearing an altered or obliterated serial number, and one for use or possession of a firearm during the commission of another offense. As Mr. Stith correctly noted, there were objections lodged prior to sentencing. There was not, however, any controverting evidence submitted, as the court is well aware. the PSR has sufficient indicia of reliability for the district court to base its factual determinations on the material in the PSR in the absence of specifically controverting evidence introduced by the defense. In this case, Judge Jack listened to the argument that the serial number was not altered or obliterated and concluded that the serial number had been altered, specifically noting on the record, it appears to me that someone has tried to scratch the serial number off, although, as Mr. Stith noted, the serial number was still capable of being read. Research discloses no definition for the term alter or obliterate, and in this instance, we would argue that it was altered and not obliterated. The First Circuit and the Ninth Circuit had both endeavored to come to terms with that, although that was in the context of the appropriate jury instruction. The First Circuit in Carter, I beg your pardon, in Adams, and the Ninth Circuit in Carter. In both instances, the circuit courts eventually decided that both alter and obliterate are perfectly mundane terms whose meaning can be derived by reference to a dictionary. In both those instances, the question arose in terms of the appropriate jury instruction. The First Circuit eventually deciding on anything that makes the serial number more appreciably more difficult to discern should be enough. And then the Ninth Circuit eventually arriving at the enhanced, it's not that it, I beg your pardon, a serial number which is not discernible to the unaided eye, but which remains detectable with microscopy is altered. The instruction that was approved was the serial number is altered or obliterated when it is materially changed in a way that makes accurate information less accessible. In this case, of course, the question is not whether it is or isn't altered. The question is whether Judge Jack was substantially correct on the record in determining that it was altered. As to the use or possession of the firearm during another offense, Judge Jack implicitly, if not explicitly, concluded that the United States and the probation officer were correct in determining that Mr. Perez had violated Section 22.05B of the Texas Penal Code, that is to say, either discharging the firearm at one or more individuals or discharging the firearm at a building, habitation, or vehicle with reckless disregard as to whether the building, vehicle, or habitation were occupied. According to the PSR, one witness testified that Perez discharged the firearm more than once in my direction. A second witness told the Corpus Christi police that she saw Mr. Perez discharge the firearm once up into the air and a second time toward a group of individuals. Either one of those sets of facts would have justified a conviction under 2205B1, discharging the firearm at an individual. At sentencing, the prosecutor also noted, and the district court took judicial notice of the fact, without objection, that it was 2 o'clock in Corpus Christi and that the bars were closing. The reason that the police were in the area in the first place is that the bars were closing and the police were trying to disperse people leaving the bars. The court concluded that discharging the firearm, the prosecutor argued and the court agreed, that discharging the firearm in essentially any direction at that time of the morning under that particular set of circumstances would constitute discharging a firearm with reckless disregard to whether or not individuals were in the line of fire. Judge Jack implicitly, if not explicitly, concluded that Mr. Perez had violated 2205, either B1 or B2. I would respectfully submit that she concluded he violated both prongs, but it's immaterial. Either prong of 2205B would be a felony offense. And as I noted in the brief, if the court is concerned about either one of the enhancements, the court need not necessarily reach the issue. Under the guidelines correction, under the guidelines calculation, Mr. Perez had a total offense level of 29, a criminal history category of 6. His advisory guideline range would have been 151 to 188 months. Since the statutory cap for the offense of conviction is 120 months, that became the advisory guideline range of conviction. Were the court to conclude, without certainly conceding either issue, were the court to conclude that one of the enhancements was improperly applied, Mr. Perez would be at a total offense level 25, criminal history category 6, which would correspond to an advisory guideline range of 110 to 132 months, which would be truncated by the statutory cap on this offense of conviction to 110 to 120 months. Judge Jack's comments at sentencing make it crystal clear that had she sustained both of Mr. Stith's objections to the PSR, which would have dropped Perez's guideline total offense level to 21 and his criminal history category to 6 and his guideline range to 78 to 97, she still would impose a sentence of 120 months. Judge Jack then cataloged the 3553A factors, including but not limited to his extensive criminal history, his predilection to possession of firearms, his predilection to use the firearms, and the PSR notes that on two occasions prior to the offense of conviction, he had discharged a firearm on one occasion into a room containing several people, and on a second occasion, he had actually shot someone in retaliation for, apparently, interrupting a barroom fight involving Mr. Perez's cousin. In sum, should the court conclude that either of the enhancements was improperly applied, the error would be harmless beyond any doubt, based on Judge Jack's cogent analysis of the 3553A factors at the conclusion of the sentencing hearing and our unequivocal statement that, had I sustained both objections to the PSR, I would still impose a sentence of 120 months. If the court has no questions, I'll yield the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Perry. Mr. Stiff?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly in rebuttal, I would like to point the court's attention to United States v. Lal, which is pretty clear and seems to follow what happened in this case pretty closely. Lal objected to a statement in the pre-sentence report estimating the victim's loss to be at whatever number that is. The court then went on to hold that, just like what I said about the Rule 32 violation, the district court has to make a finding as to each objection or determine that the challenge material would not be considered in sentencing. That wasn't done in this case, and it needs to be done. Whether or not the judge would still follow through on what she said about giving an upward departure may or may not be the case after the court says you can't consider these things without proper findings. I don't know, but I think that's something the court needs to do. And about the firearm in connection with another felony, I found that page I was referencing earlier, and it's on page 12, line 5 of the sentencing transcript. He has such an extensive criminal history that, again, being in possession of a firearm, firing it anywhere in the city limits is extremely dangerous. That is exactly the Class B misdemeanor. And so it's certainly ambiguous, if not relatively unclear, as to what findings she was making and what she was basing that enhancement on, granting the enhancement. So I don't believe that the government overcame their burden in establishing that this crime was committed in conjunction with another felony, nor do I believe, as was the case in Carter, that the firearm had a truly obliterated serial or a truly altered serial number. The firearm in Carter, which opposing counsel has stated, you couldn't even see with a naked eye. That's much different than a firearm that can be made out with a naked eye by an agent. So for those reasons, I'm asking the court to return this case for resentencing. Certainly, I'm sure Mr. Perez would like another go at it, but I don't think that's probably the right thing to do, but certainly for resentencing in light of Rule 32 and for the court to make the appropriate findings. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Your case is under submission, and we noticed that you're court-appointed, and we wish to thank you for your willingness to take the appointment, and you've done a good job on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Judge.
Last case for today.